Welcome, everyone. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for being here today. The National Museum of the Mighty 8th Air Force is proud to welcome award-winning author Steve Snyder. This talk is particularly important because yesterday, on February 8th of 1944, so 75 years ago yesterday, pilot Howard Snyder and his crew aboard the Susan Ruth were shot down. And so I welcome his son, Steve Snyder, who wrote a book to tell you the story. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I'm absolutely delighted and excited to be here today. It's an honor to be here. I love the Mighty 8th Museum. This is my seventh visit here. And tomorrow will mark the fifth time that I've come on Super Museum Sunday to sign copies of my book. So it's always wonderful in this venue. Being in the chapel is really special. So I thank you a lot for coming out to hear the presentation today. With me is my son, Clayton Snyder. It's his first visit to the museum. So that's he'll come here again later though this year. I'm immediate past president of the 306 Bomb Group, and we're having our annual reunion here in Savannah this November. Also, I'd like to acknowledge a friend of mine, Rick Baruth. We played basketball together on our high school team in California. He drove up from Jacksonville to see us today. As I mentioned, I'm with the 306 Bomb Group, and to me, the mission of the 306 Bomb Group is to remember, honor, and educate. To remember the air war over Europe, to honor the men who fought it, and to educate the public about it. And that's really the goal of my presentation. And the presentation is pretty much geared toward the general public. Most groups that I present to know very little about the air war over Europe or the 8th Air Force, have never seen or been in a B-17. And so for some of you people that are very knowledgeable in the crowd today, a portion of the presentation might be a little rote for you, but I think after that you'll enjoy what happened to my dad and his crew. Growing up, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history. I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed with the 8th Air Force in England. His plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. And he flew bombing missions over occupied Europe and Germany, and on February 8th, like Heather mentioned, he and his crew were shot down over Belgium. And he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture, and he eventually made it back to England. But it wasn't until I retired in 2009 that I really had the time to delve into my dad's war history in more detail. And at that time, I had no intention at all of writing a book. I just wanted to go through all the material my parents had kept from the war years, and they kept quite a few things. Two items were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action about his plane being shot down, which was absolutely riveting. So much so that it was included in two books that were written. On the left is The Mighty 8th by Gerald Astor, about the 8th Air Force, which was stationed in England and flew their first mission on August 17th of 1942. And their goal was to hit industrial and military targets in order to cripple Nazi Germany's ability to make war. The term The Mighty 8th was coined by the noted historian Roger Freeman because the number of planes they could put up in the sky on missions, which numbered into the hundreds. And on December 24th of 1944, 2,000 bombers hit Berlin. I get excited when I see one B-17 on the ground and flying. I can't imagine what 2,000 bombers look like flying overhead. The other book was First Over Germany, written by Russell Strong. It was about the 306 Bomb Group, which my dad was in. Russell Strong was a navigator and after the war became the historian for the group and started the historical association. The 306 motto was First Over Germany because they were the first bomb group to hit a target in Germany on January 27th, 1943 when they bombed Wilhelmshaven. The 306 Bomb Group was also the longest serving bomb group in the 8th Air Force. They arrived in England in September of 1943 they didn't go back home until December of 1946. They stayed on after the war, involved in the Casey Jones Project, was the photo map, aerial mapping of Western Europe and Northern Africa. The other item that was really significant were all the letters that my dad had written to my mother, which she kept while he was stationed in England. And my dad was very candid in those letters. He wrote about what bombing missions were like, what life was like in the base, what life was like in London and England at the time, the escapades of him and his crew. And reading those letters was absolutely fascinating. And I became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew, and it became my passion. I started reading book after book about the air war over Europe. I went on the internet, spent countless hours doing research, downloading declassified military documents. I went on a quest to find relatives of all the crew members of my dad's to see if they had any letters, pictures, articles that they could send to me about their veteran. I joined a number of World War II organizations, started going to reunions, listening to veterans tell their stories. And finally, after 3 years of research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that people needed to know about it and read about it, and so I decided to write a book. From the time I started my research to the time the book was published was 4.5 years. It took me 12 months to actually write the manuscript and another 8 months to publish the book. I published it independently. I formed my own limited liability company called Sea Breeze Publishing after the name of the street that I live on in the state of Seal Beach, California. And then I contracted with independent professionals for all the associated services, such as cover design, interior layout, editing, printing the book, etc. And the book was finally released in August of 2014. Since that time, it's won close to 30 book awards, and it has a 5-star rating on Amazon. First half of the book kind of builds up to the day the plane was shot down, and then the second half of the book is all about what happened afterwards. And the book is not just about my father, but it's about what happened to each member of the crew, because something different happened to each guy. And it's also about all the courageous Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help them. The book's all based on, the story, I should say, is all based on first-hand testimony by the people who were involved in the events that took place. What I added to the book was a lot of historical information and anecdotes about and surrounding the war to put it in context and give it background. But I probably wouldn't have written the book if it wasn't for two Belgian gentlemen. In the upper left-hand corner, you see my dad with his bomber jacket on with Dr. Paul Delahaye. And in the lower right-hand corner, you see me with Jacques Lalonde. Both these men were young boys during the war, and they were greatly affected by it. They saw firsthand the atrocities that the Nazis committed against friends and family. And after the war, when they became local historians, and they interviewed Belgian people, Belgian members of the Belgium underground about events that took place involving my dad and his crew. And they documented that testimony. And they gave me unbelievably detailed information about events that took place that would have been lost forever without their dedicated research. So I owe them a great, great debt. Paul Delahaye passed away in 2013, but Jacques is still with us and a real good friend of mine. Initially, my dad didn't go into the Air Force, so the result of the first peacetime draft implemented by President Franklin Roosevelt in the fall of 1940, my dad went into the Army in June of 1941. He was stationed in Fort Lewis, Washington. And at the time, the U.S. military was woefully weak. They ranked 18th in the world in military strength behind Romania. And also, they were very, very ill-equipped, as you can tell by the World War I vintage uniform that my dad is wearing there. A few months later, in July of 1941, my dad married Ruth Hempel. They got married at First Lutheran Church in Pasadena. My mother was born and raised in Pasadena shortly after she graduated from UCLA. I also was born in Pasadena and went to UCLA. She was actually a classmate of the legendary Jackie Robinson all through school. And it was January 31st it was, and on February 7th, just recently passed, both Jackie and my mother would have been 100 years old if they were still with us. My dad was born in Norfolk, Nebraska, and then he moved to California with his family at the age of 13. Shortly later that year, on December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor and the United States was at war. My mother was very concerned and afraid at that time. The future was very uncertain. So over Christmas, she went up to visit my dad in Washington, and 9 months later, Susan Ruth was born. Well, at the time, my dad was kind of concerned. He has a new bride, a baby on the way, and he wasn't sure how he's going to be able to support him. He didn't think he could do that very well in a private's pay in the Army, so he decided to volunteer for the Air Force, where he could make more money, especially if he made it through flight training and became an officer. So in June of 1942, he went through pre-flight training in Santa Ana, California, and then went through the various stages of pilot training. There were three stages of pilot training. This slide is a little difficult to see. The first stage was primary training, and then after primary training, they went into basic training. And pilot training was really tough. 40% of the guys that started pilot training washed out. It was very difficult. After basic training, they went into the third phase, advanced pilot training. And the pilots were separated out at that time. They either went into single-engine fighters, or clickers, there it is, either single-engine planes or fighters, or they went into multi-engine, twin-engine planes, transports, or bombers. Typically, the shorter pilots went into fighters because of the cramped conditions in the cockpit. But personally, I also think it was based on personality. It seems to me those fighter pilots tended to be pretty cocky, have big egos, be risk-takers, pretty independent. Whereas the bomber pilots tended to be a little more level-headed and team players. My dad was 6'3". They sent him into bombers. Here you see a picture of my dad in primary training. This was a big day for him. It was right after he soloed. And you could tell that by, you couldn't wear your goggles on your helmet until you soloed. So that was a real proud moment for him at that time. I think everyone smoked back then. He went through primary in Santa Ana, California. These are the three planes he flew in pilot training up top. In primary training was on a Stearman biplane, and then in basic training, a Multivalium single-wing plane, and then advanced training, twin-engine 18-9 Curtiss Wright. He graduated from advanced pilot training in Douglas, Arizona in April of 1943, where he earned his commission as a second lieutenant and got his pilot wings. And from there, he went to Pilot, Texas, where he learned how to fly a four-engine B-17 bomber in transitional training. And then he went on to Dalhart, Texas, for operational crew training, where the various members of the crew came together, and they learned to operate as a team. And then once deemed ready, they were assigned overseas to the European Theater of Operations. And on October 21st of 1943, my dad and his crew reported to the 306 Bomb Group at Thurlow, England. This is what the base looked like at that time. It's no longer there, but the surrounding countryside looks just the same. I'll be visiting there again this August. There is a nice little museum, 306 Bomb Group Museum there. It's contained in one of the remaining buildings from the base. This is the insignia of the 306 Bomb Group. There were three air divisions in the 8th Air Force. The 1st Air Division was signified by the triangle. And then each bomb group has a designated letter. The 306 was an H, so the triangle H represented the 306. Many of you, or most of you, have seen the 1949 movie, The 12 O'Clock High, starring Gregory Peck. Well, that was based on a true story about the 306 bomb group. The 918th group, the fictitious bomb group in the movie, the 918th, was derived by multiplying the 306 3. Another distinction of the 306 Bomb Group is that their flight surgeon, Dr. Thurman Schuller, was responsible for convincing 8th Air Force Command General Ira Eaker to implement a mission limit. Until that time, there were no mission limits. Guys just flew until they were shot down or killed. And the morale of these flyers was going down and down. So Dr. Schuller figured they needed to have a mission limit, something they could shoot for, a little light at the end of the tunnel. He suggested 20 missions. Eaker set it at 25. And then when Jimmy Doolittle became commander of the 8th Air Force on January 6th, 44, he eventually raised it to 30 and then 35. Every bomb group had four bomb squadrons. These are the bomb squadrons in the 306 up in the left-hand corner. You have the clay pigeons, so named by a journalist because they took such tremendous losses. I believe that the 367 squadron had more losses than any other bomb squadron in the 8th Air Force during World War II. Then you have the Grim Reapers, the Eager Beavers, the Grim Reapers, and then my dad's bomb group, the 369th Fighting Bighton. I always like to point out the ground crews. The combat crews got all the glory and the credit and the publicity, but these ground crews are really the ones that kept these planes flying. After bombing missions, these planes would come back, and these guys would stay up all night long, repairing battle damage, doing maintenance, replacing the engine and tires. Usually the weather was very inclement, you know, very cold, rainy, muddy. And they really took great pride in these planes. They considered these bombers to be really their planes, and they just loaned them out to the combat crews occasionally to fly missions. So they were really the unsung heroes. Here you see my dad's crew, a B-17, had a 10-man crew. In front, you see the four officers. This is my dad on the lower left. He was the first pilot, and as such, the commander of the plane and the crew. And then going across, you have the co-pilot, the navigator, the bombardier, and then standing behind them are six enlisted men, non-commissioned officers, who were mainly gunners. Five of these men made it back home, five of them did not. This is not the Susan Ruth. That's just a B-17 that they took their picture in front of when they arrived in England. You'll notice the nose art here on the upper on the left. I love the nose art. It's interesting that that Air Force was the only entity that allowed their planes to be painted. The Navy didn't, the Marines didn't, nor did other countries. But the Air Force thought it would help the morale of the young guys if they could personalize their planes by naming them and painting them. And they were very creative in what they named and painted their planes. A lot of times it was a cartoon character, but more often than not, it was a scantily clad or a nude woman. You know, after all, these guys were in their late teens and early 20s, and they were fairly young men. The 306 flew B-17s. It was nicknamed a Flying Fortress because of the armament on the plane. They had 12 to 13 50 caliber machine guns. They could put out a tremendous amount of battle and firepower. And they can also absorb a tremendous amount of battle damage and continue flying. Each plane had identification tail markings. Here you're getting to see the triangle H of the 1st Air Division and the 306 bomb group. Also, each plane had a specific tail number on the plane that identified that bomber. The Boeing company designed and produced 64% of all the B-17s, but Lockheed Vega, and the Douglas Aircraft Company each produced 18% of the bombers as well. Here you see the crew positions on the plane. Let me back up here. There are actually three different models of B-17s that were flown in the European theater. There was an E model, but they only made a little over 500 of those, so that was quickly phased out by the F model, which was eventually replaced by the definitive B-17, the G model. You can always tell the G model by the chin turret underneath the nose of the plane. And here are the crew positions on the plane, and again, this is the G model with the chin turret. Up in the nose, you have the bombardier, the navigator, above them, the two pilots, flight engineer, top turret gunner, bomb bay, radio operator, bulk turret gunner, two waist gunners, and a tail gunner. And the bombs hung on, and the bomb bay on racks. This slide is a little difficult to see, but you see the bombs here. And it was really cramped in there. That catwalk is only 8 inches wide, and that boy walking across it is only 8 years old. So you can see how cramped it is if you've never been in a B-17. They look like a big plane, but they're really not. They're really more cramped than a submarine. Occasionally, bombs would get hung up on those racks during bomb runs, which would require one of the crewmen either to take a wrench and knock it loose or kick it loose with his foot. And I can't even imagine what that must have been like. When those bomb bay doors are open, you're looking 5 miles down straight to the earth, and that wind's howling all around you. So they had to take me a lot of courage to take a lot of courage to do that. Here you see the crew positions in a little more detail. This is the F model without the chin turn and the nose. You have again the bombardier. His job is to drop the bomb successfully, but in the G model, he also manned that chin turret when they were under attack by enemy fighters. Then behind him, you have the navigator, who needed to know where they were and where they were going. And under attack, he manned cheap guns that were on each side of the nose of the plane. And then up above them, you have the two pilots. And you needed two pilots to fly these planes, not just in case one was injured or killed. But it was very strenuous, both mentally and physically, to fly these planes. These missions lasted 6 to 10 hours that are very lengthy. Back then, you really had to use muscle to fly these planes, unlike today. And they had to stay alert at all times, or else and they were flying in these tight formations. They could clip a wing on the plane next to them or run on the plane in front of them and go down. Also, they had to continually fight the turbulence of the sky. You had the normal turbulence of the weather that would churn the sky up. But you also had the turbulence of all those bombers flying in such close proximity to one another. All the wake turbulence and prop wash would churn the air up. So it was very difficult to fly these planes. And the co-pilot flew the plane just as much as the pilot did. Then above them, you have the flight engineer. Also, he manned the top turret when they were under attack. But he also helped monitor all the instruments that were in the cockpit. There are over 150 different gauges, toggles, switches, etc. And so he would peer over the pilot's shoulder to monitor engine performance and fuel consumption. And then after the bomb bay, you have the ball turret gunner, or excuse me, the radio operator, which was the most comfortable position on the plane. He had a nice chair to sit at, a fairly roomy compartment. And then you had the ball turret gunner down below. And that was the most cramped position on the plane. Again, these missions were 6 to 10 hours long, and he's in that cramped field position for hours on end. Had to be very uncomfortable. Then above the ball, you have the two waist gunners, which were very exposed positions, and then the tail gunner in the back. My dad and his crew flew their first combat mission on November 3rd of 1943 to Wilhelmshaven. It was the first time the 8th Air Force put up over 500 bombers on a mission. And flying combat was extremely dangerous and brutal. There were 26 men that were killed in the 8th Air Force during the war. That's more than the entire Marine Corps fighting in the Pacific. Another 28,000 men became prisoners of war after their planes were knocked out of the sky. Being a combat crewman in the 8th Air Force was the most dangerous duty assignment in the United States military during World War II. And it was dangerous from the time they took off to the time they landed. At its peak, there were 40 bomb groups in England and the area around East Anglia, which is about the size of Vermont. And these bases were located about 5 to 10 miles apart. So on the day of the mission, you had hundreds of bombers taken off from these bases all at the same time. And back then, there was no radar, no air traffic control. Everything was based on visual sight. And the weather was usually socked in England, so they couldn't see anything until they got above the clouds. So bitter collisions were not uncommon at all. And then they had to form up. Individual planes formed up into three-plane elements. Elements formed up into bomb squadrons. Bomb squadrons formed up into bomb groups. Bomb groups formed up into combat wings. Combat wings formed up into air divisions. And all this took 1 to 2 hours before they could even begin their mission across the English Channel. Then they had to deal with the elements. These planes were not pressurized for above 10,000 feet. They had to go on oxygen, or after a few minutes, they'd pass out and they could die. Also, it was extremely cold at the altitudes they were flying. It was minus 40 to 60 degrees below zero. So frostbite was a huge problem, and many airmen were hospitalized for lengthy periods of time with serious frostbite injuries. One of my dad's waist gunners spent 2.5 months in the hospital because of such serious frostbite injuries. The next thing they had to deal with was the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force. The Germans had radar stations set up along the continental coast of Europe, so they knew when these bomber formations were coming, and they'd send up their air force to attack them. Here you see a waist gunner in his combat uniform with a steel helmet, tinted goggles because of the brightness of the sky at that altitude, his oxygen mask, This is a flak jacket that had metal plates in the front and the back of it to help protect him from shrapnel. And then his fleece-lined jacket, pants, thermal boots, and gloves. And then this is a parachute harness, this white strap. And they didn't actually wear their parachutes in the plane because it was too cramped. So if they needed to bail out, they have their wherewithal about them to find their chute and then hook it on, or clip it on hooks to the back of the harness and jump out of the plane. Here you see a waste spitter again firing his 50 caliber machine gun. Again, his oxygen mask and flak jacket. You see all these spent cartridges on the floor of the plane, and that was like stepping on ball bearings or marbles. And then you see him firing his 50 caliber machine gun. Here's the ammunition. The ammunition came in belts that were 27 feet long. So if he fired the whole belt, he said he fired the whole 9 yards. And that's where that expression came from. At the beginning of the war, it was 8th Bomber Command's belief that these heavily armed bombers flying in tight formations of hundreds of bombers could defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. They didn't need fighter support. And they flew in what was called the combat box formation. This is the combat box of a combat wing. And then within the box of the wing, you have 3 boxes representing bomb groups. And then with each box of the group, you have 3 boxes representing bomb squadrons. So the thought was all that interlacing firepower could fend off the Luftwaffe. Here's another view of the formation from on top, the side. There are 3-dimensional formation. You have a lead squadron, a high squadron, a low squadron, and then from the back. Unfortunately, 8th Bomber Command was sadly mistaken. These bombers could not defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. In the early years of the war, especially in 1943, the 8th Air Force took devastating losses. Even though they implemented that 25 mission limit in the spring of 43, it was statistically impossible to complete 25 missions. The average number of missions flown before being shot down was only 6. And the losses culminated in the fall of 1943 in what is known as Black Week, when during that week they flew 4 missions and lost 148 planes, almost 1,500 men. The worst day was Thursday, October 14th, known as Black Thursday, when they sent 291 bombers to hit the ball bearing plants at Schweinfurt, Germany, and 60 were shot down. 10 of the 15 planes of the 306 bomb groups were shot down that day. Well, after that, the 8th Air Force was in shock. They pretty much stood down for the rest of the year. They didn't fly any missions into Germany, only flew a handful of missions. There was just no way to sustain those losses. And they seriously considered giving up daylight bombing. It wasn't until the beginning of 1944 when the P-47 Thunderbolts were got external fuel tanks, and with the introduction of the P-51 Mustang, that these bomber formations finally had fighter escorts that could take them all the way to the target and back. The P-51 Mustangs were particularly effective. They basically wiped out the Luftwaffe by the time D-Day rolled around on June 6th. The next thing they had to worry about was an aircraft fire. Here you see a flak gun. Flak was the abbreviation for the German word for aircraft defense cannon. And these were deadly weapons. They would fire 20 shells a minute. They were calibrated to explode at the same altitude that the formations were flying. And these shells were filled with different types of shapes and sizes of razor-sharp metal. Called shrapnel, that when the shell exploded, the shrapnel would just burst out and explode hundreds of feet. From a distance, they looked like innocent black puffs, but as these formations got closer, those puffs got bigger, the noise got louder, and once in among the flak, the concussions from these exploding shells would just violently rock the ship. My dad said even though it was so cold at that altitude, he would just be sweating profusely from the adrenaline running through his body. When they neared the target, they reached a point called the initial point, the IP, where they started their bomb run. But at that time, the first pilot gave control of the plane to the bombardier who flew the plane through the Norden bomb site, which was a revolutionary device. It was an analog computer that could calculate the altitude, the speed of the plane, wind speed, etc., so they could accurately drop the bombs. It was very highly secretive as well. The bombardiers had to take oaths that they would defend the Norden bomb site with their life. At the time, though, little did the U.S. know that the Nazis had that spy, Hermann Lang, in the Norden bomb factory, and they knew all about the bomb site. After the bombardier, here you see the bombardier looking through the crosshairs of the Norden bomb site. Once he dropped the bomb, he would yell, "Bombs away!" And that would signal for the first pilot to take control over the plane, who then would make a huge turn and go to another pre-designated point, the rally point, to try to make it back to England, where once again they'd be attacked by enemy fighters. It was on a mission on November 8th of 1944. My dad and his plane dropped their bomb successfully, but the bomb bay doors got hit by flak and they couldn't get him back up. And as a result, that caused a drag in the plane. They lost airspeed, and they started lagging behind the formation. And they were singled out by two Focke-Wulf 190 German fighters who came in for the kill. And in the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. Two of the crew members were killed in the plane. The other eight crewmen were able to bail out. But both those Focke-Wulf fighters were shot down as well. One piloted by Siegfried Merritt crashed. He was killed in the plane. And the other was piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out and made it through the war. While I was doing my research, one day my wife asked me, "Well, why don't you find the pilot that shot down your dad's plane?" I thought to myself, what a ridiculous idea. She doesn't know what she's talking about. That's impossible to do that. You know, the guy probably died during the war, like most of the Luftwaffe pilots did, or it's 70 years later. He's passed away by now. I can't speak German. But like a good husband, I did what my wife told me to do. And lo and behold, I found Hans Berger. And I interviewed him for the book, and he gave me some wonderful insight into the book about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force. My dad was the last one to bail out of the plane. His parachute came down just north of the French border in a little village of Mackenwaas, Belgium. And his parachute got hung up on these trees, and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and couldn't get it down. But fortunately for me, for him and for me, or else he wouldn't be here. A couple of young Belgian men came to his rescue before the Germans got to him. They saw his plight. They went back to a farmhouse, got a ladder and a rope, helped him down this tree as one of the men that came to his rescue, Henri Franken. And he sent these pictures to my dad after the war. In the book, there's over 200 time period photographs. So you can visualize everything that you're reading about. This occurred about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It was daylight. So they told my dad to stay put and hide because they thought it was too dangerous to try to move him in daylight with Germans in the area looking for him. So he stayed put, but that night they came back and got him, and they took him to this farmhouse. This is the farmhouse of the other Belgian man, Raymond Dervain, where he lived with his parents, Edmund and Ida Dervain. And this house is still there today. It's right on the French-Belgian border. That house is in Belgium, but the trees are in France. He stayed there one night. They thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that with those German patrols in the area. So the next night, Belgium's customs officer, Paul Tilkin, came on a tandem bike to pick him up and take him to another location. My dad had some shrapnel wounds in one of his legs, and he could only pedal with one foot. And when they came to a hill, they weren't able to pedal up it anymore. So they started pushing the bike up the hill. And it was pitch black. It was a rainy night. When they got to the top of the hill, there was a cabaret, a cafe there. The lights were on. Music was playing. People were laughing, talking loudly. And all of a sudden, two Luftwaffe officers came out with young girls, with their arms around young girls, and one of them comes up to my dad, puts his arm around him, and asks my dad for a light for a cigarette. My dad's petrified. He can't speak German or French at this time, but fortunately, Paul could lit the guy's cigarette, and they let him go on their way. My dad said these officers were too drunk and too interested in these young girls to pay too much attention to a couple of guys pushing a bike up in the rain. And after that, my dad was moved from place to place to place. How long he stayed in any given house depended on how brave the people were who lived there and how dangerous the underground thought it was for him to stay there. These are a few of his Belgian helpers. My dad, you know, since then, he wore berets all the time since after that. Two of the people in this picture, he stayed with lengthy periods of time. They were on the left, just Jislaine Bayou, who was her and her husband, Maurice, and my dad wrote that diary. And then the other woman to the right is Jeanette Gaudin. Her husband was a captain in the French army who had been captured in 1940 when Germany first invaded the lowlands in France, and he spent the remainder of the war as a POW. And he said, like I said, stayed in lengthy periods of time with these people, and they kept in touch with them after the war. They became good friends. And the people that hid and helped my dad, or any down there, and for that matter, were unbelievably brave people. They risked their lives and those of their friends and family by hiding these down airmen. If the German secret police, the Gestapo, found out about it, they'd be immediately arrested, tortured, and either shot or sent to concentration camps. And some of the people that helped my dad and his crew met that fate. Paul Tilquin, who I just showed you, a couple months later, he was arrested, tortured, sent to a prison camp, and very narrowly escaped being executed. The U.S. armies were coming up, and the Germans left the area before they executed him. But his belt was broken, and he died in his early 50s. It was also very stressful for my dad, too, or I think for anybody who bailed out, was hiding. You know, first of all, his plane's on fire. He has to bail out of the plane. He comes down in a foreign country, has no idea where he is, doesn't know what happened to his buddies on the crew, can't communicate with the U.S. military, and he's being helped by people who are total strangers. They can't communicate, they can't speak the same language, and any of those people could be a collaborator and just turn him over to the Gestapo. So that had to be very, very stressful. And he was almost found out several times. Those are listed, talked about in the book. On one occasion, this is the house in Charleroi, Belgium, where Maurice and Jislaine Bayou lived. That house is still there today. In fact, Clayton and I were able to go in that house just this last year. And on one occasion, there was loud pounding on the door, and it was the Gestapo, and so Maurice told my dad to get up on the roof. You can't really see a very good picture, but there's a steep tile roof, and in the roof line was this little tiny window. So he told my dad to get up on top of the roof and stay there until he came to get him. So my dad, and it's very steep on this roof, and my dad spent the entire night there. Maurice never even came back and got him that whole night because he thought it was too dangerous. And I said there's a number of instances in the book where he was almost captured. Finally, my dad got tired of hiding. Word came that the Allied troops had landed at Normandy and in June, and he decided to get back in the fight. After all, he had a year's infantry training up in Washington, so unlike most airmen, he knew how to fight on the ground. So he decided to join the French resistance. His helpers tried to talk him out of that because they thought it was way too dangerous, because if he was ever captured, the Germans would just shoot him on the spot. But he convinced one of his helpers, Amy Cools, to take him across the border into France, and he rode on bicycles across the border, and she took him to a French resistance group called the Maquis. The Maquis were ragtag, independent guerrilla groups located all across France. They're pretty rough characters. They basically tried to harass the Germans. They disrupt communications, sabotage railroad lines, attack convoys, assassinate German officers. And they got their instructions from the British through the coded messages over the BBC. And they were supplied by the British through airdrops. And my dad said the information that they would give to them was unbelievably accurate. If the British said there'd be a German convoy coming down this road at this time on this day, sure enough, they'd be there. And there's a number of instances in the book of encounters that the Maquis group had with the Germans. This is not the group that my dad belonged, but it kind of gives you an idea of what the Maquis looked like. There were about 20 in his group. They were led by a French lieutenant who had escaped from a German prisoner of war camp. There was a mixture of Belgians, Frenchmen, and some Algerians, who my dad said were particularly fierce fighters. For a while, they stayed in this farmhouse again, which is still there, just across the border in Wallers, France. This picture was actually taken with a telephoto lens from Belgium. That's the farmhouse itself. I took this picture in 1994, my first visit to Belgium with my parents. Here you see my dad standing in front of the farmhouse, and he stayed in these upper rooms up here, which Clayton and I climbed up in. It was pretty thrilling to be right there in that spot where my dad stayed with the French Resistance. Here you see the back of the farmhouse. And on one occasion, my dad was upstairs there, and he saw a German patrol coming up the road, and so he jumped out of one of these two windows and had to hightail it into the woods to avoid being captured. This next picture is pretty incredible. Who took it and how it got back to my dad, but we'll never know. But this is him fighting with the resistance, jumping out of that Jeep. Finally, 7 months after bailing out, word came there were U.S. troops in a nearby city or town, cities around there. It's all rural farmland. In the little town of Traylon, France. So my dad walked into town, into the town square. I went up to an army major. Actually, it was an element of Patton's 3rd Army that had come up through France after D-Day. Identified himself, was interrogated, and he went to Paris and then finally went back to his unit in England. I've been to Belgium 5 times. I'll be going again, my whole family will be going again for the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium. And on my dad's plane shot down in September. But Belgium's a unique little country. Even though it's small, there's so much history there. There's so many battles that were fought. World War I, Napoleonic Wars, and so forth. But it's a unique country, and it's divided in two. The upper half of Belgium is called Flanders, where they speak Dutch. And the lower half of Belgium is called Wallonia, where they speak French. And my dad and the crew bailed out the plane. Can't see that my little marker tool. Came down right around here. Actually, my dad and the plane came down in Belgium. And the other guys that were bailed out came down in France. And then you can see, this is Charleroi, where my dad stayed for a while. And then that resistance farmhouse where they stayed in Traylon, France, is right around. And the Belgian people are wonderful people. To this day, they are still so grateful and so thankful for the Americans coming to their rescue and liberating them from Nazi occupation and Nazi oppression. And they've erected a number of memorials in the area. And on the anniversary of those events, they have ceremonies. The ceremony, I'll mention that in a second. The big ceremonies, though, are around September 2nd, which is the anniversary date of the liberation of Belgium. And the celebrations last several days. This is a poster from the celebrations at the 70th anniversary in 2014. And they're wonderful events. They erect these big tents. That's just part of the tent where you can see hundreds and hundreds of people. All the villagers come out and they have parties and lunches and dances and dinners. All the local volunteers dress up in period outfits. They have a U.S. military vehicle parade and an encampment. The local beer, Chimay, just flows. And everyone has a swell time. They also have ceremonies at the various memorials. This is the memorial at Cendron, which is right at the French border and where the 9th U.S. Infantry first crossed over from France into Belgium to liberate the country. And they do a great job of educating the younger generations about the importance of remembering. And you can see in this picture that have all the young people lined up right there in front, so they have a first row seat. And all the dignitaries come down, make speeches, the U.S. military, Belgian military, French military. 5 years ago, the U.S. ambassador to Belgium, Denise Bauer, came down with a contingent, and they're wonderful events. This is the memorial to my dad and his crew in Mackenbos, Belgium, and they will have a ceremony tomorrow to celebrate, really not celebrate, but to commemorate my dad's plane being shot down yesterday on the 8th. The memorial has two plaques on the front. It has the names of the each member of the crew, their crew positions, and how old they were when the plane went down. Like most World War II veterans, my dad didn't talk a lot about the war growing up, and that's why I just knew the basics. But this memorial was erected in 1989, and he and the three other crew members that were still living at the time went over for the dedication. And it was there that he was reunited with all those Belgian people that hit him during the war, saw those places where he was hidden, and that brought it all back, and he started talking about it after that. Here you see him making a little speech in 1989. Paul Delahaye is here on his left, and then the people on his right, the first person is Jeanette Gadin, who was in that photo that I showed you earlier. And next to her is Nellie Tilcan, the wife of Paul Tilcan, the Belgian customs officer. He had passed away before then. And then the man to the right is Raymond Durvan, who was one of the two Belgian men that rescued him from the trees. And Raymond is still alive today. But this was a picture of the dedication. As I mentioned, I've been to Belgium several times, but one of the most memorable trips there that Clayton and I went on is after Belgium, went on to Munich, Germany, where we met with Hans Berger. And this is what Hans looks like today, the Luftwaffe pilot that shot down my dad's plane. But actually, my dad, and I should have mentioned it earlier, the gunners of my dad's plane shot Hans down, so really they shot each other down. He brought out his flight log and showed me his entry on February 8th of 1944, where he shot down a B-17 and he had a bailout of his plane. He's 95 years old now, and we've become good friends. Here you see my dad and myself at the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. He wanted to see it before he died. It was 2004, and I accompanied him on a reunion for the Air Force's Escape and Evasion Society, and it was right before the official dedication, and that was a wonderful trip. It was the last trip he ever took. My dad died in 2007. He wasn't the last crew member to die, but he was the oldest crew member to die at 91. And virtually all the World War II veterans are in their 90s today. At the end of World War II, there were 60 million veterans. And most of those great men are not with us anymore. Less than 4% of those veterans are still with us. There was no other event in history that affected more people than World War II. 60 million people were killed, millions more were wounded, millions more were homeless and displaced. It changed the course of America and the world forever. And the brave young men who fought and died for freedom were without doubt the greatest generation. Their sacrifice must never be forgotten. It's our duty to remember. Thank you. The only exception that I'm aware of to that rule was Chuck Yeager, who personally met with General Eisenhower and talked him into going back into combat. Another thing is that my other sister, I have two older sisters, my other sister, Nancy, was born when my dad was missing in action. So that was really tough on my mother. She's home not knowing if her husband's ever going to return. And here she is with a one-year-old baby girl and an infant girl. If you read the book, there's lots of excerpts in the book from letters that my dad, other crew members, relatively crew members wrote, which makes it personal. But in the letters my dad wrote back to my mother, he's always referred to the baby, she was pregnant then, as Steve or Stevie, but it turned out to be Nancy. I came along later.
Did he talk about your dad, about what he enjoyed the most? Because I know it was war, but everybody found things they enjoyed, and what he disliked the most about it?
Good question. The question was, what did my dad liked about the war? I really can't answer that specifically, but in letters he wrote, he stated that it was really exhilarating at that time. You know, back then the U.S. was very provincial. The majority of the people lived in rural areas out in the country. A lot of these guys had never been out of their hometown or their county, and all of a sudden they're halfway around the world, you know, fighting a war. And my dad said that it was just an exciting place to be. London at the time was, well, there was no city like London in the world. And there was such a mixture of people there, because from the occupied countries, you had these people from Poland, France, the Netherlands, plus the English Empire at that time, you had all these, East Indians and Gurkhas and from Nepal, and it was just really collection of people. But it was really exciting. He said that if he hadn't had a family, a wife and kids, that he would have, if he hadn't gotten shot down, that he would have re-upped for another tour. Because it was an exciting place to be. You're with your comrades and you're fighting the, for freedom. Two died in the plane.
And then eight of them
bailed out.
What happened to the other seven? What were your stories like?
You need to read the book. I can tell you about my dad because I'm here and I wouldn't be here if he hadn't made it back.
Do you know if any of the crew were found after they went to hide?
Yes. Yes.
Did he ever describe his first mission to you?
Well, yeah, like I said, he was very descriptive in those letters, and he said that first mission was pretty scary, but he wrote that after a while that the missions didn't bother him. He didn't get scared at all. He was used to it, and pretty calm. You know, he would get that with that adrenaline, he'd be pumped up, but he wouldn't have fear. He was used to it. On another one of his missions, they got hit, and a couple engines were knocked out, so that was a little dicey. But my dad actually didn't fly as many. Well, another misconception that some people had is that these crews all flew together every mission, and they flew the same plane every mission, which wasn't the case. My dad flew six different B-17s. He was shot down on a G model, a brand new G model, before he could paint it. My dad was captain of the basketball team. He was at 6'3" back then. He was tall. But he tore the ligaments in his ankle, and he couldn't fly for a couple months, so some of his crew members had more missions than he did, but they always had replacement crew members because of the weather. Everyone was getting sick, coming down with the flu or pneumonia, or they'd be injured in the plane. So you constantly had replacement crewmen. My dad's full crew only flew two missions together, intact.
Yeah. What does the military do in terms of reclaiming
Well, back then they had I forget exactly what it was called, like the War Graves Commission or Department, whose job was to locate deceased airmen. And then they would contact the relatives of the soldier or airman, and then their relatives had the option of whether they wanted to bring the body back and have it buried in the U.S. or have it buried in one of the American cemeteries in Belgium or the Netherlands or what have you. We have my dad's crew of the five that were killed. Three of the men were brought back, and two of them are buried in Europe, one in Belgium and one in the Netherlands.
So how many missions did your dad fly?
He was shot down on his eighth mission. Yeah, some of his crew had 11, 12, but then there were other crew that only had five.
If he was lost in action for 7 months, did your family, your mother, grandparents ever talk about what they went through, not knowing what his status was?
Well, most of that I have in the letters that were exchanged between family members. My mother, being the wife of the pilot, was kind of the central point. And she kept all those letters. There's excerpts from those letters as well in the book, either from mothers of the crew, wives of the crew, sweethearts of the crew, about what they went through and how gut-wrenching it was, not knowing if their loved ones were going to return. There were some men that became POWs, so they were able to write back home. And so they knew that they were safe, and they were able to tell relatives, a couple crewmen had died. But whereabouts of several of the crewmen was unknown. My dad was actually the first of the five to make it back to the U.S. And that gave people a lot of hope. They go, well, Howard came home. Maybe my loved one will come home too. Some of them did, some of them didn't. Yes.
Was there any question whether he was going to be retrained on AB 29 in Sent Okinawa, like some of the crews were after the European War was over?
Not really, because he came back to the States in 44, late 44, and then he became a B-17 flight instructor in Florida and then in Ohio. Actually, he had to crash land a B-17 in Ohio. I have pictures of that. I think that's why he said, I'm getting out right now.
Was there any question
Did your father fly again after the military?
No. Now, people have to come. I'm a pilot, but I go to air shows all over the United States. But no, he just wanted to get out and get on with his life. And so he never flew general aviation at all after the war.
Was your father able to communicate with his family when he was in the resistance?
No, he wasn't. My mother got a letter on February 23rd. They were shot down on February 8th, notifying her that the crew went down and they were missing in action. And then she didn't hear anything else until my dad got back to England and sent her a telegram, which is in the book. My dad did write a couple letters to her while he was in hiding before he joined the French Resistance, but they never got to my mother. Because he knew that they'd be worried, to death about him.
And we have time for one more question.
Yeah. Do you know how many planes that German pilot shot down?
Yes, he shot down 8 planes, 7 B-17s and 1 Spitfire. Yeah, when I met with Hans at his apartment, he put on his flight jacket, his black flight jacket with his Iron Cross, and he showed me these pictures. He had these photographs from his gun camera. Where I kind of get chills just talking about it. In his sights, here's a B-17, here's a B-24, here's a, they weren't all from his gun sight, but some of them were, and some were from other German pilots. A B-38 Lightning, every Allied plane. Those are pretty cool. If anyone wants a copy of the book, the gift shop sells them up front, and I'd be glad to autograph it for you. And I really thank you for coming out today and for your attendance. I greatly appreciate it. It's our duty to remember.